and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be discussing Bong Joon-ho's latest...
Something or other.
Parasite. Regular listeners to the show will know that we've been trying to see this film for some weeks, months even. There was just a long delay between when it got released in New York and Los Angeles and when it finally made its way out to little old Michigan. But we have finally seen the film, and it is something else, as one can say about most of this man's films, is wild. So, Matt, you want to take it away?
We're introduced to a family, father, mother, son, daughter, living in a cramped, kind of squalid apartment in the slums, and it's a, they called it a semi-basement.
Yeah, apparently that's just a thing in Korea, I guess.
It reminded me of whatever it is, like the 13th and a half floor in Being John Malkovich, where everyone has to kind of penguin waddle under the roof. You know, it's got like half of a window that looks directly out onto the street. So it's slightly below ground level without being a proper basement.
It's kind of like a split level house, except the only thing you have is the sort of kind of basement
part. Right. And the only thing they can see through this half window, more often than not, is some drunk urinating on a brick wall. This is a fairly common occurrence. The drunk is chased off by a friend of the son's, a college student, who drops by to give the family a gift. It's a, some kind of ceremonial rock, like a paperweight, or not? It's a bit too big to be. I don't know. Is this a custom that I'm not familiar with?
That's the impression that I got. It's okay. Also one I'm not familiar with. I think they referred to it as a scholar stone.
Uh-huh.
Apparently, this friend's grandfather just collects scads of these, which in a sense kind of diminishes the value of the gift. I feel like it's like, take one of these off my hands.
Right, exactly. But, I've just been tripping over them.
It's supposed to bring them material wealth and success.
Mm-hmm. And they have been hustling. They, being the family, have been running all kinds of odd jobs. When we meet them, their apartment is overrun with stink bugs, and somebody starts spraying pesticides outside, fumigating, and they...
The father says, don't close the windows, we'll get free extermination service.
There's this terrific shot of them, of the dad specifically, just furiously assembling pizza boxes surrounded by toxic fumes. Because they're trying to secure some kind of gig assembling pizza boxes for a understaffed pizza delivery company. And it doesn't quite work out. But this visit from the college friend brings more kind of fortuitous developments their way. He's been tutoring a high school girl, and he tells his buddy, listen, I'm studying abroad next semester. You should pick up where I left off. And the reason that he's recruiting his friend, who is not college educated, is because he doesn't trust any of his poonhound frat boy friends to not try to seduce the girl who he has a thing for, apparently.
So
in short order, this guy forges papers with his sister's help, impersonates a college student, and picks up where his buddy left off. And he's a real smooth operator. He kind of charms the mother and the daughter. It's a nuclear family unit, mother, father, son, daughter, same as theirs. The kids are younger, and the house is incredibly opulent. It was the former abode of an eccentric architect who I think designed it. And it's a lot of 90 degree angles, a lot of wide open spaces, very imposing to look at. Not a lot of places to hide, I guess, which becomes important later. you feel very exposed just standing in any of the rooms. There's just a lot of empty space around you at all times. The mother thinks that her son, who's at most 9, I don't remember the exact age, is some kind of savant, like a very gifted painter.
The tutor plays along. There's a scene where they're looking at one of his paintings on the wall, and he's raving about it. And says, so it's supposed to be a chimp, right? And the mother says, it's a self-portrait. And he says, oh, yes, yes, of course.
Yes, the mind of a child artist is inscrutable to the adult eye, or something like that.
Something like that.
He fumbles and then saves it. The whole movie is full of little interactions like that, where the jig could be up at any moment, but then through quick thinking and quicker reflexes, they manage to avert disaster. I say they because over the course of the next 20 or 30 odd minutes, the entire family ends up infiltrating this house. First, the sister poses as an art tutor
slash art therapist.
Yeah, because she secures her position by inventing a trauma that's afflicting the boy that he's trying to get out through his art. And the mother latches onto that immediately. And they both, the brother and sister, both just play the parents like fiddles. It's really kind of exhilarating. It's a very delicate sort of role play that emerges where they're pretending to be much haughtier and much more refined than they actually are. But the fact that they can fake it as well as they do starts eroding some of these class boundaries, and I'll get into that more after the break. But the idea is that, I don't know, fake it till you make it, I guess. Isn't that what they tell you? Yeah. When you're on the bottom.
So the daughter sets up their father to become this family's new driver by planting a pair of her panties in the car as their current driver is giving her a lift home, making it look like he's some kind of poon hound having it off in his boss's car.
In the back seat, no less.
In the
back
seat.
Which is the real indiscretion.
Apparently.
The dad is very uptight about that. You know, so they immediately sack him. My favorite thing about that scene is that the entire time that the well-to-do father and mother are talking about what should be done about this panty crisis, The father is sucking on what looks like an astronaut food pouch. It's some kind of Gogurty kind of thing that he's taken out of his fridge. It's like a very, I don't know.
It's very bougie.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So the con artists line up their father to be the replacement driver, which goes off basically without a hitch. And then they next scheme to remove the housekeeper, which is a much more involved process than in any of the three initial hires. Basically, they have to trigger this woman's peach allergy through this peach fuzz dusting trick. And basically, they convince the woman of the house that her current housekeeper has tuberculosis and is not telling her.
Right, and has been washing all of her dishes and preparing food for
coughing
her,
on things,
her family.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And the woman of the house, who has been pretty guileless up to this point, just buys it hook, line, and sinker. They have to resort to such extreme measures because this housekeeper has been with the house. Her tenure actually precedes the current family moving in. She
goes back to the architect.
Yeah, she worked for the guy who designed the place. And the mother says at one point, oh, she knows this house better than I do. Too true.
Too true.
So she is kicked out on her ass, and the upper class family is going to go on a weekend camping excursion for the son's birthday. So all four of them pack their bags and hit the road, and our erstwhile heroes move in and start making themselves at home. You know, they don't trash the place, but they're having a good time. It reminded
me. Well, they trash the living room a little bit.
A little bit. I was like, because the dad is yeah. There's an altercation between the father and mother where they're all drunk and he pretends like he's about to fly off the handle about something. He like smashes a bottle and then they all laugh it off. So things are getting out of hand, and it seems like it's gonna be it reminded me of The Servant, the
Dirk Bogarde.
Yes, exactly. And I thought that it was going to be sort of a subdued, slow burn like that, with things just incrementally ratcheting up as they assert more and more control over their employers. But
and I mean, it's not unreasonable that Matt came to this conclusion. I did too, because at this point we're like probably a good hour in
uh-huh.
to the film. And it's not like this film is 3.5 hours or anything. It's long, but it's not that long. So you think you kind of have a handle on this movie, and then Bong Joon-ho says, no.
This movie has a handle on you. There's a scene early in the movie where the would-be tutor, the imposter, grabs his student's wrist and says, your pulse is racing. You need to manage your test anxiety better. If you keep doing what you're doing, you're going to flunk. And it felt at times like Bong Joon-ho was grabbing my wrist. I was really stressing out. Basically, from this point onward, the movie never lets you relax.
No.
So what happens is the former housekeeper shows up. It's raining torrentially, and she's hammering on the buzzer, saying, let me in. I left something in the basement. I'll just grab it and go. And needless to say, three of the four current occupants of the house are not supposed to be there, so they all hide. And the mother, the new housekeeper, lets in the old housekeeper. Old housekeeper is in a bit of a state. She's acting awfully peculiar. She runs downstairs and proceeds to wedge herself between the wall. All of a sudden, you just see her scurrying halfway up the wall like a spider. She's wedged herself between a heavy shelf and the wall, and she's trying to push the shelf out of the way. The new housekeeper helps her, revealing a secret door. Door opens, revealing a secret staircase.
Down into a fucking bunker.
A secret bunker. This was the most alarming moment of the entire film for me. It was just hearing the former housekeeper exclaiming, honey, honey, I'm here, I'm here.
I had no idea what the fuck was going to happen for the rest of the movie after that.
It's a major what the fuck moment. She descends into the darkness, and you realize that she's been keeping someone down there for years and years and years. She moved in her husband, who is on the lam, I guess. He's in very dire debt to some apparently pretty dangerous people. And so she's been just sneaking him food through her whole tenure with this family. Basically, ever since the architect moved out, she moved him in, and he's been living in this bunker that the current family doesn't even know about.
Yeah, the architect didn't disclose its existence to them, which is obviously a boon for her and her husband. So, all the while, the new housekeeper is threatening, like, okay, I'm going to call the police. The old housekeeper is trying to sweet talk her. The rest of the new housekeeper's family is perched on the stairs.
And then they have a straight-up Little Rascals moment where they all come spilling out at the same moment and sprain their ankles and elbows, and they're all, you know, like, oh, Dad, get off me.
And a switch is flipped. Suddenly, the old housekeeper knows she has the upper hand, even though, frankly, she'd still have a lot of fucking explaining to do.
But, well, she even says something to that effect. It's like, we'll all go down together or something like that. Whereas there's no, you know, we're through the looking glass here, people. I mean, there's no, both tricksters. I mean, we're running a very particular scheme. And when those schemes collided, it's like they're all the rules get thrown out. You said it best. I mean, there was just no telling what was going to happen next from here on out.
Yeah.
There's no telling what these people might do to each other because this was something that I'd kind of intuited before the movie dropped this bombshell. The old housekeeper looks very prim and proper and kind of meek and mild mannered up to this point. I suspected that she was going to be a little bit of a hustler like them, you know, that she's clinging on to this position with her nails and teeth and that she was going to fight for it. I did not expect any of the fucking Jane Eyre craziness with the husband in the basement or the sub basement. So then
some fuckery ensues. So the old housekeeper has taken cell phone video of the pile of interlopers groaning about their sprained ankles and whatnot. And she is basically holding them hostage in the living room
with her finger on the send button
and making them like pose uncomfortably in one corner of the room. And then she and her husband start kind of reminiscing about how nice it was when the house was unoccupied and the two of them could just hang out in the living room, and the sunlight shining in. And then suddenly it cuts away from this flashback and there's a slow motion charge from the four members of the con artist family just all going for the phone at once. And then there's this scrum.
It's really the only word for it.
Somehow, four people can't seem to get the upper hand on two people until finally...
Try to subdue her with peaches, which was pretty funny.
They go to the fridge, they grab a bag full of peaches and just dump them on her. And eventually, they do get hold of the phone.
Yeah.
And they delete the video and whatnot.
And the fracas is then interrupted by a phone call on the house phone. The torrential rain has sort of put the kibosh on the camping excursion. They are 8 minutes away. The rightful owners of the house, they'll be home any minute.
And they want ramen. They want ramen when they walk in.
Yeah.
Which is the most rich person thing I've ever heard.
Mm-hmm.
So the mother, the new housekeeper, is scrambling to make this ramen, which she has never made before. She's looking at YouTube tutorials and whatnot, boiling water, while the rest of them are trying to move these two other fucking scam artists down into the bunker to hide them.
Yeah, and just clean up the mess caused by their habitation.
Yeah,
you know,
they only have 8 minutes, they can't really clean it up. They're pushing crumbs under the couch and shit, under the table, just out of direct view. I mean, it's something else. Eventually, the daughter is camped out under the table in the living room. The son, who has been reading his pupil's diary, probably just to read about himself.
Yeah, because they've hit it off in a big way. They've started canoodling during their tutoring sessions.
He's replacing one volume of the diary and then ends up having to hide under the girl's bed, and the dad is down in the bunker with the two other people that they're keeping in the bunker, and then the mother is finishing the ramen as the rich folks come in.
Yeah, the old housekeeper sustains a pretty serious head injury. The new housekeeper kicks her down the stairs at one point when she tries to jump out and spoil everything.
It kicks her down the stairs without a look back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's real cold-blooded.
Yeah.
And so the pair in the basement are forcibly restrained by the father, who then sneaks upstairs. And long and short of it is all three of the people who are not supposed to be there wind up taking cover under a very wide, very low to the ground coffee table of sorts in the living room. They're trapped there for the better part of the night because the boy, who we haven't mentioned up to this point, has a real fascination with playing cowboys and Indians. He was a Cub Scout.
Yeah, mostly just Indians.
Mostly just Indians, yeah. He's always running around with like tomahawks and feather headdresses and what have you. He is just completely unwilling to accept that he is not allowed to go camping for his birthday. So he camps out in the backyard in the rain.
His teepee out there.
Yeah.
And he's talking to his dad on walkie-talkies, which they've also been doing for the last half hour, 45 minutes, whenever they're on screen, basically. Yeah.
Point being that his parents spend the night on the couch to sort of supervise him, or at least be within earshot, keep a watchful eye on him. So then the three under the table are caught in the crossfire. Eventually they slither out, but not before hearing the two of them on the couch getting into some hanky-panky and then talking about how the new chauffeur has a sort of peculiar scent that they find noisome and unpleasant. But
it's poor people.
They're describing the smell of poverty, but he like can't quite put his finger on it. He says that, you know, sometimes you get a whiff of it on the subway.
Yeah,
that sort of thing. And the father the father under the coffee table is very put off by that.
Understandably so.
Yeah.
So there's another segment shortly thereafter where the two kids get out because their mother has let them know that the homeowners are asleep finally, and the dad is making his way to the stairs, and he has to basically plank because the little boy in the teepee radios his dad, wakes him up, shouting emergency, which turns out just to be that he can't fall asleep. And so the con artist dad is just laid out, again, like he's planking, you know, stiff as a board, unmoving, and somehow...
Well, everyone knows that rich people's visual acuity is based on movement.
They truly are velociraptors. So eventually he gets out, and then they're making their way back to their home in the semi-basement, and it's still raining. It's been raining this whole time, and when they get home, when they get to their street, the entire street is flooded with, like, raw sewage. And they're asking each other, oh, did we leave the window open? Oh, shit, you know, what are we going to do? And, yeah, sure enough, their place is flooded again.
It's basically underwater.
With sewage. I mean, it's like halfway underwater, and the water's rising all the time.
The toilet is vomiting up this tar-like substance. It's, like, explosively.
There's this incredible shot where the daughter has, like, found a pack of cigarettes. And she takes one out and lights it.
Pops a squat,
like with the lid and the seat on the toilet closed, and but it's just like kind of, constantly pushing up.
Yeah, it's just
under her,
impotently gurgling
and like spitting all around the rim, just spinning this vile sewage.
Yeah,
while she's just like trying to keep it together and have a smoke. It's something else.
So then they end up being relocated to some kind of FEMA camp situation.
Yeah, like a gymnasium. Yeah. So they all individually get contacted the next day because the rich people decide they still want to celebrate the kid's birthday, even though none of them are scheduled to work that day. It's like, oh, well, we really like to have you here, blah, blah, blah. So even though they're all, like, presumably still smelling like raw sewage, camped out in this gym with a bunch of other people, and there's also this scene of presumably the authorities trying to explain what's going to happen in the background while the son is, like, getting text messages from his pupil. Like, my mom asked me to have you come, and I really want to see you, blah, blah, blah. Meanwhile, these people are just screaming at these guys in hard hats.
Yeah, the disarray reminded me very much of some of the scenes early in The Host, like when they're the comical over the top grieving scene where you know, the people are still shell shocked from the first kaiju encounter, and there's just everything's descended into bedlam. Bong Joon-ho has a penchant for scenes like that, I think.
Yeah.
And for having multiple planes where there's crises happening in the background that have nothing to do with what's happening in the foreground. Yeah. It really makes you feel like you're in the thick of it.
Oh, I shouldn't neglect. There's a scene while they're trying to sleep in the FEMA camp.
Oh, yeah, which is kind of the movie's mission statement, I guess. Its thesis statement.
Yeah.
To use the language of a tutor.
Right. Father and son are talking to one another, and the son wants to know what the plan is. What are we going to do about those people in the bunker? What are we going to do in general? And the dad says, the best plan is no plan. Because when you have a plan, things never go according to that plan. Do you think any of these people were planning on sleeping in a gym tonight? No. Better to not have a plan. Nothing means anything.
Yeah, and no plan can't go wrong.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
The next day, they're all tasked with doing different menial bullshit in preparation for the son's big day.
And this is when you really get a sense of sort of the double-edged meaning of the title. And I mean, I'll go into this more after the break.
Sure.
But just what these rich fucks are, like, wringing out of these people who work for them at a moment's notice when they're not even supposed to be fucking working that day. It's just like, do this, do that. Go get these tables out of the basement and arrange them in a crane's wing pattern.
And do it quietly. Because the son is still sleeping in the tent.
It is fucking 10.
Because he was up all night.
Yeah. It's...
Yeah. Yeah, it hit a nerve, needless to say. Actually, I got called in early to work tomorrow. Like, right after... Like, I turned on my phone after the lights came up and the credits started rolling, and I had a text, "Hey, can you cover for me?" And I,
yeah.
Well, okay, we'll get there. So the party goes awry very quickly. The son and the father, the two imposters, are both kind of coming unglued mentally. The dad is sort of shooting daggers at his employer because the two of them are dressed up like wild Indians, and they're supposed
to...
hiding in the
bushes.
Yeah, right. They're supposed to attack playfully the mother, who's going to be carrying the birthday cake, and then the son is going to come to the rescue. And it's just a kind of demeaning, dehumanizing charade that...
Well, actually, it's the daughter, right?
But isn't that...
The con artist daughter. No, she's the one who's supposed to be carrying the cake.
Isn't that... Okay. It wasn't clear to me if that was a last-minute bait and switch, because the mother has the line about how...
That
was
the plan.
Okay. She refers to it as art therapy cake, or like trauma pie or something like that. Something absolutely ridiculous. And it's like, oh, only you can be the one to carry it. But I wasn't sure if that was the plan from the beginning or if that was just the mother having kind of an inspired diva moment.
Right.
But in any case, the son, the tutor, he has been clutching this rock that his friend brought him at the beginning of the movie all night long, sleeping on a mat in this gymnasium. He still has it. He is walking down into the basement in order to presumably brain both of the people holed up down there.
So he gets downstairs and he gets into the bunker and he gets down there, and there's this great shot where he's just kind of like standing looking at what may or may not have actually been, it didn't really matter, but what he believed to be the old housekeeper's body, just sort of laying there, poking around a corner. And it's just a close-up of his face, and a fucking wire loop is emerging from behind his head.
Yeah, a noose kind of halos around his head and then, yeah, slips around his neck.
Yeah, he gets yanked back by the old housekeeper's husband, who has gotten himself loose. And he manages to get free and runs upstairs and gets yanked back again, and eventually he gets brained pretty good a couple different times by the husband, who has become fully unglued. I mean, he's already clearly not well in the head earlier on, because he's formed this kind of obsessive relationship, pseudo-relationship with the owner of the house, of the house, sort of shouting about how much he respects him, just shouting the word respect in English. And he does this thing. There are these buttons.
There are these lights in the house that you assume for the first hour are just motion activated, because they turn on whenever someone walks upstairs or whenever the father specifically, whenever he passes down this hallway, the lights alight above his head. We come to find that they are not, in fact, motion activated. They are operated manually, or well, by
with this man's forehead.
Yeah, so not manually, just as the case may be.
cranially
operated light bulbs. It's he has this kind of deity worship supplication relationship with the master of the house. Respect. And he occasionally tries to spell out messages to him in Morse code with the flickering lights that they naturally just think that something's gone haywire.
Yeah. So he has presumably murdered one of his captors.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes upstairs and he grabs a knife out of the kitchen and he goes outside and nobody is looking at him. There's this big crowd of bunch of bougie fucks all looking at the festivities in front of them, and he's just kind of standing there, shields his eyes from the light, because this is the first time he's been outside in over 4 years, and he just charges out and stabs the daughter, the art therapist, who is carrying a cake. She hits him in the face with the cake.
Yeah, it's a real Larry, Curly, and Moe kind of defense mechanism.
Yeah, her dad and the man of the house both run outside. From here, it's just chaos.
Yeah, it's a bloodbath. I mean, there's just, it's a t- total melee, and the daughter is bleeding out. The dad is applying pressure to the wound, and
the owner of the house is shouting for the car keys because their son's like having a seizure, and we need the car keys. We got to get him to the emergency room, even though there's this girl like clearly fucking bleeding out on the ground.
Yeah.
And they don't give a shit because she's the help.
Yeah, it's not his first seizure, incidentally. He had one years earlier, also, I think, on his birthday, when he snuck downstairs to eat some leftover cake and saw a ghost.
Which was just the old housekeeper's husband.
Right.
His eyes poking up from...
Jesus Christ.
That shot is absurd.
Yeah, that shot is genuinely disquieting. But also... fucking cartoonish.
Yes.
In a way that like gets it's like seeing it through the eyes of a child, in that it's both terrifying and also
kind of funny.
Kind of, yeah, right. It's really good stuff. And I kind of wish that the kid, the birthday boy that is, had seen him first when no one else did, standing,
yeah, that would have been
on
good.
The edge of the crowd, looking like a ghoulish bloody specter. You know, taken in the sunlight. I think that was a little bit of a missed opportunity, although that so much shit hits so many fans here that might have detracted from it in some way. I don't know. I'm not Bong Joon-ho.
Yeah. So he throws the keys while he's trying to keep his daughter from bleeding out. They don't make it.
They're intercepted by the maniac brawling with his wife. Not the maniac's wife, Jesus Christ. The maniac brawling with the new housekeeper, who skewers him with a kebab.
with a big fucking kebab, yeah. And there's this moment between the old housekeeper's husband and the man of the house where he's shouting like, "Oh, Mr. Park, respect." Mr. Park just rolls him over so he can get at the car keys underneath.
And in so doing... crinkles his nose.
Yeah.
A fatal miscalculation.
Yeah, he smells poor again. And Mr. Kim, the driver / con artist / soon-to-be grieving father, just fucking snaps and grabs the knife that stabbed his daughter and just buries it in the man's heart. And the guy obviously just drops like a stone. And yeah, everybody's fleeing at this point. We see in the background that the daughter of the rich folks has retrieved her paramour, bleeding profusely from the head, from the basement, carrying him on her back, which is impressive given their size differential. So she's fleeing with him. The murderer, Mr. Kim, sort of flees we know not where, and his wife is still trying to save their daughter's life. And that's when... it cuts to black.
Yeah. To no avail, as we soon learn.
We soon find out.
The son, who instigated this whole debacle, the tutor, awakens in the hospital some weeks or months later and starts laughing hysterically. It was an almost, like, they don't play it up. It's not this gothic or melodramatic, but it's a very, like the Joker seeing his reflection or something.
Yeah.
Mirror. It's just, like, loopy. He's, yeah. You know, and his sister has died. Even when he goes to pay his respects, he's still got this deranged smile on his face.
Yeah, his mother's weeping. He's not there.
The father is AWOL.
Yeah. And eventually we see the son kind of like watching news reports on the goings on after there's a scene of the two of them getting off with probation after all of their fuckery. Because in the end, they...
forged some documents.
They forged some documents. The two of them didn't do that much that was that illegal. it's really their patriarch. He's a murderer, so he's the one that the authorities want. But anyway, things continue to die down, and eventually we see the son going on a hike. And he like climbs up this mountain, and then he's looking down with binoculars at... the house, the rich people's house. The survivors have moved out of, and now there's like a German family living in there. And he says, "And one night I decided to stay later than I usually did," and he sees one of the lights blinking, and suddenly it dawns on him That's where his father disappeared to. He got back into the house and went in the bunker. And he marks down the dots and the dashes in the blinking light and then goes home and translates it. And it's this...
very long missive.
Very long letter from his father, who basically just describes what it's like down there. Time is hazy. I realized this was my only way out. It's been difficult. It was particularly tough when nobody was living in here, but I'm okay, and we'll figure something out. I'll see you when I see you.
Yeah. So the son resolves to pull himself up by his bootstraps, make a lot of money. Doesn't say how. Probably doesn't know how, but he's fantasizing about sooner or later buying that house, moving in with his mother so that his father can emerge from the bunker and they can be a family again.
And it looks for a second like it's going to end on that note, just like this wide shot of the father walking to the glass door and the two of them hugging and it fading to black, but then it goes back to the semi-basement and the son's just sitting there and he's writing this letter, and it looks like he's writing it in Morse code, and I don't know, and I don't think he knows how he's going to relay that to his dad, because it's not like the light trick is going to work in both directions.
Right.
He's still impoverished. He's stuck in the semi-basement, and he's saying, I don't know how long it's going to take, but I'm going to do it. So, you know, until then. That's the movie. That's Parasite. So we'll go ahead and take our break, and then we'll be back with our thoughts in just a moment.
It's something very natural to talk about the rich and poor in this era, in this age, in this time. So in everyday life, we always encounter those kind of who is rich, who is poor, and why kind of question almost every day. It's quite natural to create those kind of story as a contemporary filmmaker, I think.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at Shock Doctors Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/shockdoctorspod, or check us out on iTunes. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
Semi-basement is very specific, the way of the Korean living for the poor people, but actually semi-basement means also semi-overground.
Yeah, so it gives you like a little bit of hope, because it's not like fully underground, but half away.
And we're back. Well, Matt, I imagine we've both got a lot to say about this movie, but why don't you take it away?
Respect!
Respect!
No, I mean, yeah, as it turns out, I don't have a lot to say. That's basically sums it up. I found myself really admiring it for the most part. I think that speaking as someone who's made a tidy chunk of change over the years, tutoring and dog sitting and house sitting, this movie hits me right where I live. You feel... always a little unnerved being in someone else's home in that capacity. And you always, even if you are actually college educated and not just pretending to be, even if you haven't literally forged documents and lied about who you are, you always feel that imposter syndrome or imposter complex or whatever it's called, it does kick in at a certain point. You feel like I'm just taking advantage of these rich people, my clients. I'm not all I'm cracked up to be. This is a common, I think, millennial experience, feeling right. Like you're just fooling everybody. I mean, it's probably not, I'm sure that my generation doesn't have a monopoly on that feeling, but the younger you are and the harder you have to work, I think it's, I don't know. The people in this movie seem, the people meaning the core family, the charlatans.
The Kims.
Yeah, the Kims. They seem mostly immune to those concerns. I mean, they really don't appear to lose a wink of sleep over. They're not getting bogged down in ethical quandaries. They're just trying to get out of that stink bug infested apartment. And the rich family that they're taking advantage of is depicted in such a way that you really don't ever begrudge them that.
No.
Like I said before the break, even when they're running the show, when they think that they've got the house to themselves all weekend, they don't trash the place, and it's not as though I thought it was going to turn into like a beggar's banquet kind of sequence where they just run riot and there's like more overt class warfare happening, but it doesn't really go in that direction. And in fact, and this is something I alluded to before the break as well, the fact that they're so adept at pretending to be art tutors or art therapists or college admissions tutors or chauffeurs or housekeepers or whatever else. Basically, the takeaway is that everyone is faking it.
Yeah.
All the time. And that the more advantages you have, the more you maybe start to feel like you're the real deal, but no one actually is. And this is an epiphany that the son has when he awakens from his coma. He's narrating in this very kind of novelistic, prosaic kind of way. He's saying, I was greeted by a detective who didn't look like a detective and a doctor who didn't look like a doctor. They don't stress this point as much as they could have, which is a good thing, I think. But I think what he's being struck by there and why he's laughing is because everyone to his eyes now just looks like an imposter. Like, you know, this is just some guy in a lab coat, or, you know, this is just some guy pretending to be a PI or a cop or whatever he is. It's all just a veneer.
You're nothing but a lot of talk and a badge.
Yeah. And that moment is prepared for because that theme runs all the way through the movie. The old housekeeper is not at all who she appears to be.
I was going
to
say she's been faking respectability this whole time while keeping her deadbeat fucking husband fed off of scraps in the basement bunker unbeknownst to her employers for over 4 years.
So, yeah, I mean, it's thematically, funny enough, the tutor in his capacity as a tutor keeps describing things as metaphorical. At times it seems like it's the only arrow in his quiver.
Right.
You know, when he's talking about the stone near the beginning of the movie, the Scholar Stone or whatever it's called, he also describes the boy's art as very metaphorical. So the movie does work allegorically, and it's got a lot of thematic heft to it, and its themes are pretty unmistakable and forceful. And there's one shot in particular that really hit me where it's when the first red flag comes up. It's as they're escaping the house after their long night trapped under the coffee table. And so you're feeling their relief at having escaped that situation. They're getting home. They can finally go to sleep. And then that relief turns into unease as you see how flooded their neighborhood is. And there's a shot of the son seems reluctant, even though they're lucky to have gotten out of the house without getting caught. He still seems reluctant to descend back into the slums. There's a shot of him on a kind of stair descending down into the onto their street, and water is just running into a sewer grate, and he's kind of staring down into the sewer, and it's like he's being washed away like a piece of garbage, you know. And then that idea is cemented a couple scenes later when the mother is talking about, oh, it wasn't that rain last night, great, it washed all the trash away. Now my son's birthday party in the backyard is going to be even more beautiful.
Yeah, and again, this is after Mr. Kim has already kind of like passed his breaking point, or at least his initial breaking point, where he's lost the facade of like sort of grinning servitude, and he's just kind of glowering in the front seat while overhearing
listening to her Travis Bickle routine. Someday a real rain will, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. It's interesting too, because there's even a certain sense of the rich people being charlatans too. And the scene that drove that home to me was the sex scene, or what essentially amounts to one. Again, when three of the four charlatans are hiding under the coffee table and the rich couple are fooling around on the couch, and they're alluding to the theoretical drug addict hooker car sex that they theorized their old driver was having, and they start role-playing with it, and the man talks about how, go get those cheap panties out of the trash, you know, that'll make me really hard. And the woman starts talking about, like, get me drugs. I want drugs. And, you know, this is This is after, during the scene significantly earlier in the movie, where they find said panties and they're aghast and they're talking about how horrifying it is that they found this stuff.
Yeah, but obviously they find it titillating too.
Yeah.
And my favorite line in that earlier scene, when the dad isn't horking down the astronaut applesauce or whatever it is in the pouch. He can only think about it in terms of like it has to have something to do with him because the backseat is his domain. So he theorizes, like, does he get off on spilling his seed on my seat? You know, surely the only reason you would have sex in the back seat as opposed to the front is to spit in his eye or something.
Or come in it, as the case may be.
Yeah, right. Or some fluid is hitting somebody somewhere. To say nothing of the fact that having sex in the back seat is just more practical.
Yeah,
you know, it's just right. It's just more spacious. It's yeah. not. It's not. It's nothing personal. The sex that never happened, incidentally.
Right. Yes.
But yeah, no. The two of them are then getting off on this kind of
imagined seedy sexual interaction.
Yeah, it's a kind of they're slumming it basically, but only
in their heads in the living room of their beautiful mansion home.
Right.
Yeah. Building off of what I briefly alluded to before the break about kind of the shifting target of the title of this film, at the beginning you figure, oh, Parasite, it's about the charlatans. And even at the beginning, you know that if that were the case, it's sort of tongue-in-cheek, because yeah, okay, they've kind of insinuated themselves into this rich people's house, and they do take advantage by like hanging out while the rich folks are away, but they at the same time they are like doing a certain amount of work. They are being paid for labor.
Yeah, so they're fake not, it till you make it, like I said.
Yeah, they're not really parasites, so yeah. Even then it's sort of tongue-in-cheek, and then you find out about the bunker and you think, oh well, I guess that couple, they're parasites. Although yeah, even in that case, again, the old housekeeper, at least she was working, even if they were taking advantage of this bunker that the owners don't know about.
Yeah, I mean, even if he is living like a tapeworm in the bowels of the house, because he seems to have embraced his role as parasite in a way that...
Worshipper of Mr. Park.
Yeah, right, exactly. Respect.
Respect.
So yeah, so if the title was going to allude to any one character, I think it would have to be him, just because he's kind of made it his brand.
Yeah.
He's living parasitically and has nothing to contribute other than bashing his head against the button that makes the light turn on.
Right. But then, as I was again saying before the break, when the movie's basically building toward the climax, you start to get the sense, and obviously this is not groundbreaking analysis or anything, but you get the sense that the rich people are the parasites, because again, they're just like sucking the energy and the labor and the free time out of their employees.
Yeah, work-life balance, what's that?
Yeah, do this, arrange these tables in this weird way, come in on your day off and fucking put on a feather headdress and help me entertain my son. You are being paid overtime. It's like, don't fuck off, though.
Yeah.
Like, seriously.
And just the this is something I know a little something about, the like emotional labor, the emotional duress caused by having to be all smiles all the time. There are nights, I haven't spent a night in a FEMA camp recently, but if I had, I would still be expected to show up at work and pantomime performative happiness, which is exhausting and is like, I think, what makes the dad snap, that you have to be a good sport about everything too. You can't just perform the work mechanically, you also have to sort of be at their beck and call.
Yeah
So there is something cathartic about seeing the madman emerge from the basement and just wreak havoc.
Yeah, so really, depending on your perspective, almost any of the named characters in this film could be referred to by the title. So it's a title that works on many levels. just to be that guy.
Yeah, right. Well, that's inevitable. And I feel like virtually anyone could walk out of this movie having gotten that, which is to its credit. I'm not saying like the movie's like a softball or that it's too obvious, because even when it is obvious, it's obvious in an impactful way. I was kind of when I was getting at that earlier, talking about the shot of the overflowing storm drains and how they're being swept back into the slums by the rain, like debris. It's a movie that wants you to know what it's about.
Yeah.
Which are different,
poor people are drowning in sewage.
Yeah. It's a difficult kind of movie to make because you don't want to just get on a soapbox and thunder on about something. You don't want your audience to go, we get it, we get it. You have to kind of walk a very fine line. How much is too much? That takes really sharp instincts as a filmmaker, storyteller, whatever else. I have to say, I cannot say enough kind things about the flooding sequence. I mean, that was the highlight of the movie for me. I said before that the housekeeper saying, honey, honey, I'm home, was kind of the moment that my jaw hit the floor the most. It's like turbulence on an airplane. It's like you've lost altitude.
Right.
Suddenly,
like
you've
just dropped 7,000 feet in 12 seconds.
Yeah, you're, it does something to your belly. That turn of events, and I was glad that I went into this movie mostly blind, just knowing the elevator pitch, basically, that it was about this family of sort of lower class people gaining access to a mansion under false pretenses. But the movie veers left and then right and then left again in a way that I found very pleasing.
Yeah, and I mean, presumably you picked up on it from the fact that maybe half a dozen times during the synopsis, we were just like, oh, yeah, and this shot. The composition in this film is
basically faultless.
Yeah, it's impeccable. It's not necessarily new for Bong Joon-ho. He's typically very good at composition, but I don't know, this movie really seemed to take it to a new level. Again, the shot with the sort of wire noose halo, the shot of the daughter on the vomiting toilet, smoking a cigarette.
Yeah, the maniac emerging from the basement and spooking the son, his bulging white eyes in the darkness.
During the flooding sequence, there's a very, very wide shot. I guess it's before they get to the stairs down onto their street, where it's the three of them fleeing down another street. And not even that much happens in this shot, but it's just the angles on it, and they're going down slope, they're already descending, and I don't know. It's a beautiful fucking movie to look at.
So I think a lot of that, it's an architectural kind of movie in this. So I read an interview with Bong Joon-ho where he talked about how they built this house for this movie to his specifications.
Oh, that's awesome.
And so because he had devised these scenes that had to play out in a particular way. Like I said before, there's not that many places to hide. It's not like they moved into this house that already existed and then came up with, oh, they'll get under the coffee table, or, oh, this is where the hidden staircase down into the bunker is going to be. He dreamed up this house and then they built it. So the movie plays out in a very deliberate way. So that feeling of like, watching a movie that never sets a foot wrong, it's like how Kubrick built a piece of New York for Eyes Wide Shut. You know, it's about having total control. And I think not every movie can or indeed should be made that way, but I think that feeling of mastery is important for this movie because it's about people, the well-to-do family, whose lives are very structured, very ordered. There's not a detail out of place. And you have to feel that sense of exactness. I don't know exactly what I'm trying to say. That sense of an ironclad status quo in order for the descent into chaos to actually mean something. But for the most part, even when things do descend, there's some handheld camera during the birthday brouhaha.
Yeah.
But for the most part, even as things go south, it's still directed in such a way that you feel like you're in the hands of an extremely capable filmmaker. And I think the whole movie has a kind of very well thought out, that's why I said architectural. It's like the movie was designed, like there was a blueprint for it. They put down the foundation and there's, you know, all the nails and boards and what have you, is everything is exactly where it belongs. It's extremely sturdy.
Yeah. There's a scene that I want to just touch on briefly because we didn't mention it during the synopsis, and it's one of the more enjoyable scenes in the whole film, and it's very funny. We shouldn't neglect to mention the fact that even though there are parts of this movie that are horrifying, this movie is very funny.
Yeah, on the whole, I would, if I were to pitch it to a friend, I would describe it as a dark comedy first and a horror film second or third.
Right. So there's a scene, it's while they're trying to get rid of the old housekeeper. And when I say get rid of, I mean get her fired. Like, this is relatively early on. And Mr. Kim is, like, telling his tale to their employer about how the housekeeper was, like, at the doctor when he was also at the doctor. And he overheard her talking about having active tuberculosis. And this is being intercut with the scene of the family of charlatans in their semi-basement home rehearsing this interaction. And his son is directing him to, like, ratchet down his emotion.
Yeah, up to and including saying, cut, cut, cut. It reminded me of William H. Macy rehearsing the phone call in Fargo, where he's pretending to be distraught. And he keeps starting over from the top because...
Oh, jeez, wait, oh, oh, God, oh, jeez.
It's like that, but even more meta, because you have the other characters present who are coaching him and
directing him. Quite literally, yeah.
It's another case where Bong Joon-ho makes you feel his presence, yes. You know.
I know we do this all the time, but it is especially true here. Because this is a film of particular merit, but the performances all around, you're great.
Yeah, and it's an ensemble piece. You've got, two dueling families plus a couple other important players. So you've got, no fewer than 10, I'd say, characters who matter. Yeah. And all of them acquit themselves admirably.
And I'm no great expert in Korean film. That said, I've seen a fair number. And the only member of this ensemble that I recognized is Song Kang-ho. If you point to, like, a Korean actor that Western audiences might know, he's probably the guy.
Is he Mr. Kim?
He's Mr. Kim.
I know I've seen him. He might be in Memories of Murder, which is still my favorite Bong Joon-ho movie. But I know that I've seen him in something.
Well, I'm pretty sure he's one of the two leads in Memories of Murder. Mm-hmm. And he is the lead in The Host.
Yes.
He's all over the place. I'm pretty sure he's in I Saw the Devil, the Kim Ji-woon film.
Mm-hmm.
And again, like, he's great, but so is the rest of the cast. And it was nobody that, to my recollection, I had seen before. So they're all great. They're all terrific.
Yeah, I mean, the ousted housekeeper is particularly good, I think, at playing what amounts to a dual role. You know, she's got... And she's aided by prosthetics, because when she's at her most demented, she's also stricken with peach fever or whatever the fuck. Right. You know, so her face is all swollen in this kind of Quasimodo sort of way.
It's almost a triple role, really, because she starts out as just this kind of, like, buttoned up housekeeper, and then there's the persona that she puts on when she comes back, and she's kind of
when cracks start emerging
and cracked and begging for help. And then there's the third persona where she realizes that she's got dirt on them too.
Oh,
and
sure.
Then, and then she's like, all right, fuckers, you know,
dance monkey dance.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, she handles all of those 90 degree turns with aplomb for sure.
I think, and you say this on the podcast more than I do, but I think it's my turn finally. And this isn't a deal breaker by any means. I'm not sure. I already said I don't know if I'd necessarily pitch this as a horror movie. I'm not sure how much of a horror movie it actually is, but it's enough of one that I still consider it part of our beat. I mean, we've definitely reviewed one or two movies that had fewer horrifying elements in them. I mean, the Larry Fessenden Frankenstein movie that we watched recently was, like, all about the pathos. It was like a love story. It was nary a moment in sight that would even make you uneasy, much less make you jump.
Right.
And there are moments in this that made me decidedly uncomfortable. But it's not as much of a horror movie as it could have been, even given what transpires in it. And what I'm thinking specifically of when the son is descending into the bunker with the stone in his hand. And at this point, he hasn't been back there since the previous night. He doesn't know if he's going to be killing one person or two.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't. The wife could have succumbed to her wounds at this point. Who knows if one or both of them has managed to free themselves from their restraints. It's like Clarice Starling going into the basement of Buffalo Bill's house. It's like you just don't know what you're going to find down there.
Yeah.
And that's a scary feeling. And the film lingers on him descending down this staircase for a span of several seconds. And then there's a cut and then he's made it to the bottom. And I just thought, if you'd wanted to, you could have dragged that out for as long as you want.
Forever.
One stare after another. Just the exquisite suspense. Really, like, unbearable tension. And obviously that's just not the kind of movie that they wanted to make, which is fine. But that was just one moment where I thought, if this was going to be a capital H horror movie, that's the moment where you turn up the dial and you make us wait for it.
Yeah,
obviously the payoff, the noose emerging behind his head, is still there were audible gasps in the theater, although that lady was rather gasp prone.
Well, yeah, she gasped like when we see the tutor kid surrounded by a pool of blood, and he gets hit with the rock again. It's like, what did you think happened? Like,
right, because you hear the first thud, but don't see it, and then you see it, and surprise, surprise, he's bleeding a whole lot.
Yeah.
Better than the guy during that Nazi zombie movie.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Who had never seen a movie before. It's like, it's a scary movie. Do you remember what he said?
I do not.
He was having a very one-sided conversation with Overlord. That's what that movie
Overlord,
was called.
Yes.
Jesus.
It's okay, man. I mean, it's been nearly a year. That was one of our first, like, half dozen episodes, so.
Uh-huh. What part of that is okay?
Sure. As you say, this is a point that I've made more often than you have, but you're right in that this isn't quite so much of a horror movie. I mean, definitely the first half of the movie, like before they go down to the bunker, it's not a horror movie. Like, it is indisputably not a
like
horror
a
movie.
A comedy of
all.
Manners more than anything.
It's like
a breezy caper comedy.
It's
almost.
It's like Dirty Rotten Scoundrels in Korea.
Yeah, it's a heist movie in spirit, at least.
And then it, you know, it's like a switch flips. The woman's like desperately trying to get inside. Like, I left something in the basement, and they're going down into a bunker. And I'm like, oh fuck! It's a horror movie right now.
Fasten your seatbelts.
And then again, as with the later scene that you're talking about with the kid going down with the rock, this is a scene where if Bong Joon-ho wanted to make more of a horror movie, as you say, capital H horror movie, he could have milked the horror of the first bunker descent much more than he did. And it's fine that he didn't. It's just not the movie he wanted to make.
Yeah, but sure. Well, like, if Kiyoshi Kurosawa had directed this movie instead, the scene of the boy sneaking downstairs to eat his birthday cake would have been 15 minutes long.
Oh, yeah.
And the scariest fucking thing ever put to film. You know, because that shot of the guy leering at him out of the darkness is like something right out of Pulse.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's pure J-horror, K-horror, haunted house goodness. Or, like, Tale of Two Sisters or something like that.
Yeah, I also, like, when she's shouting, like, honey, honey, I'm here, like, I didn't know, is the dude going to be dead down there? Is he going to be, like, a quadruple amputee?
Right, is it going to
be
some
audition situation?
Like, yeah, right, is it going to get really Takashi Miike all of a sudden?
Is he going to look like the sloth guy from Seven? I mean, like, you got no idea. And again, it just turns out he's hungry and kind of in a daze. So, yeah, this definitely is far from the most horror movie that we've ever done on this podcast, but it is obviously no less the film for it.
Yeah, I mean, and I tend to cast a pretty wide net when it comes to, well, horror in particular, but that's just because it happens to be my favorite genre. So I like seeing horror elements crop up where you're not expecting them.
Yeah.
You know, that like almost automatically endears me to a movie. If like I wasn't feeling it, and you sprinkle in a little axe murder or something, then, you know, I'm
axe murder, kill.
On the subject of The Lighthouse, actually, I want to stress something that I almost brought up when we were reviewing The Lighthouse. I might have said it, just not in so many words. I've seen movies that content-wise, are way more bonkers than anything that happens in Parasite or in The Lighthouse, that depict things that are really out there. But there's something to be said for a movie that depicts a descent into abnormality or insanity in a way that's credible enough that you're sitting there watching it and you just find yourself thinking, this is crazy. Like, and it happens, I find, and this is true of The Lighthouse as well. Parasite is kind of designed the same way, where the routine is established, and it's a very firm routine. In both cases, you've got a power dynamic where in The Lighthouse, it's Willem Dafoe running the show, and in Parasite, it's the wealthy family who are calling the shots. And in both cases, you're shown what things look like when they're going according to plan, and then that plan very quickly deteriorates and then disintegrates completely.
That's why it's better not to have a plan.
Yeah, exactly. No plan can't fail. And I think because those movies are set up in that fashion, when the shit hits the fan, you really feel it. You know how far you've strayed from normalcy. And that's what makes the deviant behavior actually feel deviant. Like it's deviating from something. It's like you're at a birthday party watching a man with a knife go ballistic. Like, this wasn't supposed to happen. I didn't sign up for this. That both movies pull off that sleight of hand very deftly, I think.
Yeah.
I'm of two minds about the ending. Well, no. I mean, I like the ending. I think it's something I'm eager to revisit because, and admittedly, this is not really a fair comparison for all the things that they have in common. They are very different movies, but I was just totally knocked on my ass by The Lighthouse. I was just like, okay, that's it. Slam dunk. Pack it in. And Parasite is maybe not like an 11 out of 10 for me in quite the same way, only because the ending is a little more elusive. Which is, I feel like, I think the tutor says as much about the kid's art. I think he uses that exact word.
Yeah.
I feel like, again, this is imposter syndrome creeping into my work. I feel like I'm just talking out of my ass. But the ending, it's strange. So first the guy wakes up from this coma. This is not an injury that I expected him to survive.
Fuck no.
He gets.
There was a lot of blood.
He gets his head bashed in not once but twice.
By a very big rock.
Yeah. And so right away there's this. It's a little bit dreamlike. You think, okay, is this like a deathbed delirium? Or maybe he did emerge from this coma, but he's not in his right mind. I mean, it's apparent that he's not entirely in his right mind because he keeps laughing. But how literally are we meant to take the dad descending into the basement and communicating to him at length with Morse code, dictating these long messages? Is that supposed to actually be happening, or is that a fantasy? And then if it is, then there's a fantasy within a fantasy, which is them all reuniting when the son buys the house some years hence. It's hard to say exactly what you're looking at in the final minutes of this movie. And I think that's probably a good thing. It may definitely be a good thing, but I'm just not there yet. I'm going to have to rewatch this one. And I don't rewatch movies very often, but I think this is one like The Lighthouse that I'd be happy to give a second day in court. Not that it needs one. I mean, the verdict is in. It's a damn fine movie.
Yeah.
But the ending was a little slippery, a little squirrely, and I need to spend a little more time chewing on it, I guess.
Yeah. Well, this has been another episode of the Shock Doctors podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandaisi.
Or are you?
Is anyone who they say they are? Podcaster who doesn't look like a podcaster.
We may or may not be the Shock Doctors. We will see you next time.
First of all, I must apologize for comparing the rich to velociraptors. If their visual acuity is based on movement, they are clearly T-Rexes. Anyhow, as always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Since a trailer full of Korean dialogue wasn't going to work, audio for the bumpers was taken from Parasite director Bong Joon-ho breaks down the opening scene, Vanity Fair, uploaded by Vanity Fair. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, December 1st, and we'll be discussing Mike Flanagan's sequel to The Shining, Dr. Sleep. See you then.